It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we ask the question, when is enough enough? What drives a chef to make his own balsamic vinegar, cure his own hams, and even grind his own flours? Is it obsession or genius? Well, with our guest, Chef Paul Bertoli, I'd bet the latter. I think this guy is onto something. Well, the Sterns have found the place for entry-level clam eaters, Pat's Country Kitchen on the Connecticut coast. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has some impish little spring wines at bargain prices. Then it's an insider's guide to Las Vegas, the places we hungry tourists never find. And we have the new Lazarus lobster phenomenon. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Suveter hyvä emäntä nouse, härjä katso maahan viitimä. Emännän viljaa kun ei tuskihin tulisi. Manuter maahan emäntä nostele, oras okinen kannon karvanen ylennä, kun ei tuskihin tulisi. Syöttele metisin syömin juottele, metisin juomin mesi heinin herkuttele, vihan nällä mä päällä.
Kun ei
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today we talk with a man who brings a whole new gestalt to cooking from scratch. Chef Paul Bertoli and his restaurant Oliveto in California keep winning awards. Now, A Clue to Why is the title of Paul's book, Cooking by Hand. And it's much more than you may think. Wine maverick Josh Wesson, who loves the little-known and bargain-priced, has some great spring wine finds. Another take on the obscure is the side of Las Vegas visitors never know. I mean where the locals eat, not the buffets or the high roller joints. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with the Stearns, Jane and Michael. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we've been on the road, but not really far from home. We've only been about 50 miles away from where we live in Old Saybrook, Connecticut.
Now that's pretty classy area, isn't it?
It is a very classy area, and it's, you know, it's a beautiful area. It's right along Long Island Sound. There's a beautiful beach near there, Hammonasset State Park. But the reason we went is not to appreciate nature, but rather to appreciate a rarity, a unique New England rarity on the menu of Pat's Country Kitchen, which is clam hash.
Clam hash?
Yes.
Yay, we found a regional specialty that Lynn's never heard of.
I don't have a clue. Okay, describe.
Well, it's chopped up clams.
Fresh clams.
Fresh chopped up clams, a little clam juice, potatoes, and onions. Just very much like corned beef hash, except instead of corned beef, imagine bits of fresh local clam. You sizzle it on a griddle. Ooh. And it gets nice and crusty, and you serve it for breakfast with a couple of fried eggs on top. It's a wonderful treat. What I find remarkable about it is that it's not intensely clammy. It's got that kind of sweet marine flavor to it, but it's kind of moist and potatoey, kind of you don't have to be a clam lover to like it. It's really
so
delicious.
It's an entry-level clam dish.
Yes,
it is entry level.
Great way to describe it.
Now, you know what else they have on the menu there, which I suspect, Lynn, you have heard of this, is red flannel hash?
Yeah, but I never remember what that is. Is that because it's not corned beef hash?
Well, it is.
Sort of.
It's doctored up corned beef. It's what it is. Traditionally, red flannel hash is made from the leftovers of a boiled dinner, and that traditionally contains beets. Hence the name, because the beets, you know, when mixed in with all the other leftovers, the potatoes, the corned beef, dye everything the color of a farmer's long johns, that kind of nice, soft, velvety red.
Right.
So it is a corned beef hash, but with the sweetness and color of beets in it.
So is Pat's kind of mainly breakfast?
No, it's kind of every meal. It's actually open.
It's three meals a day.
Late hours, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. And, you know, Pat's is funny. It's been around forever. And if we walked in there now, not having known about Pat's for 20 years, we might turn around and walk out because it is the kitschiest decor. I mean, it is
real cute.
Wall to wall teddy bears and the waitresses with calico dresses and, you know, really tons of like stinky, you know, smelly candles and country crafts with a K. But the food
You're so
is
complimentary,
really, Jane. No, the food. You get Yankee dishes there that you can't get anywhere else.
It's what's known as a family-style restaurant.
So, you know, this really does sound like a little microcosm of old-time New England.
In some ways it is. I mean, not necessarily an authentic microcosm of old-time New England, but a kind of cute, nostalgic one.
But the recipes are very authentic.
Oh, they're the real thing, yes.
And even Pat Brink, who's the owner, her clam chowder is just
delicious,
spectacular,
classic. And for dessert, whatever else you have, this is one of the few places in Connecticut where you can have dessert of grape nuts pudding, another Yankee classic.
Do you know what that is?
Yeah, that one I do know, but it's been a long time.
It's a custard, but with the grape nuts in it, and the grape nuts are in it long enough so that they, instead of being those crunchy things that they are when you pour them out of the cereal box, they kind of turn into just kind of streaks of grain throughout the custard. It's a wonderful idea.
Mm. I think
even though it has driven me insane for how long have we been married? 39,000 years. That Michael says grape nuts pudding when it's grape nut pudding.
No, it's grape nuts pudding because that's the name of the cereal.
All right, you two. If you're going to spat, we're going to have to say goodbye now. But thanks a lot.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bye.
I'll take care of Jane later.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
So if you go for oysters and I go for oysters, I'll order oysters and cancel the oysters. For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling off. Let's call the whole thing off.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're roaming the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers at Organic Valley. Now, every week we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique, and some shopping tips. Best of all, it's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. What I love about wine expert Joshua Wesson is that he's a great cheap date. Now, here's a guy who's been sommelier in some of the priciest restaurants in New York. And what does he turn to do his own business? Hunting down great wine at under 15 bucks a bottle. He's got Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, I have to tell you, this is my kind of man. Hey, Josh, good to have you back.
Thank you for those kind words.
You are welcome. Josh, I am up to my ears in new spring greens. I need some new spring wines. Any thoughts? Mm.
Oh, of course. You know, springtime, my first wine trip to Europe was to France, and it happened to be in the spring. Many years ago, and I always have a soft spot in my heart for France in the springtime. And there are a lot of great wines in France that are great spring wines, but this past year when I visited Europe and went to France, I looked for wines that were wildly different, that offered a little something that Muscadets and Beaujolais didn't have. So I found a triptych of great spring wines that are a little bit weird, but weird in a delicious way, in the service of making you laugh.
Laughable wines. We're always looking for something like this. Okay. Which is the first one?
My first stop was in Alsace. And everybody knows about Alsatian Gewürztraminer, which would not be a great spring wine because it's so rich and big and full of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And Alsatian Rieslings, which would be great spring wines, but they're a little obvious. I love Alsatian Muscat and Alsatian Silvaner because they have this positively hard core of acidity that makes your mouth water. And when you're thinking spring and you're thinking light and you're thinking I'm shedding off my down parka and running in the fields, you want to drink something that's light and elegant. And Silvaners from Alsace, I think, are just the ticket.
So which one have you picked?
Kunstbar is a particularly delicious Silvaner. They call it the tradition, Silvaner tradition. It sells for all of $13. And it's just a phenomenally delicious peach and apricot scented wine that has this core of citrus that's impossible to stop drinking. I mean, I defy anyone to put this bottle down once they've put a glass in their mouth.
Okay. Where else are we going to go now in France?
Well, I mean, you can't say spring and think wine and not think of rosé. And France makes a bunch of great rosés. There are very famous ones from the Loire, and there are famous ones from down in the Rhone. But I went to the southwest near Toulouse to find a fabulous little wine from the Côte Frontenay called Bellevue La Forêt. It's made from Merlot and a grape that's grown nowhere else in France called Negrette. And they take these two grapes and they squeeze them and let the skin stay in contact with the juice for half a day.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with this gorgeous pink wine that has the richness of a Bordeaux in a way, which
really?
Is just a little bit to the west of the Frontenay. But it they also have the lightness of a Loire rosé. It's got a little bit of something for everyone who likes pink wine. And it's dry, but fruity, and another winner with a wide range of spring foods.
And how much a bottle?
This is $11, and I should say that whenever people are buying rosés, they should always buy the youngest vintage, because rosé is not a wine that you want to put in your sock drawer and come back to in a year or two.
Yeah. Okay, so we've had a white, we've had a rosé. What about a red?
Of course, there are lots of light reds for spring. Loire Gamay is one of my favorites. And there's a little appellation called Côte Rouennaise near the town of Rouen, which is technically in the Loire, but in fact closer to Beaujolais than it is to Muscadet. And you've got this wonderful, light-hearted red wine that could easily be mistaken for a rosé or a white if you closed your eyes. And because of that chameleon-like quality, this Domaine du Pavillon that I opened about a week ago, it really is, it's blessedly free of all the things that you don't want in a spring wine. It doesn't have a lot of alcohol, it doesn't have a lot of tannin, it doesn't have a lot of sugar, it doesn't have a lot of anything that would get in the way of your sitting back watching the sunset and enjoying a glass. It's just delicious. And it's $11 too.
I'm thinking of sitting in a field of flowers with my glass of wine. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his spring wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, you got the wines. Now let's talk the greens. Now, I think for spring greens, you should start on the lawn. I mean this. You should look for the very beginnings, the tiniest, tiniest leaves of dandelion. Now, if you haven't fertilized or done the chemical thing, you pick them right away. You chill a bottle of the Sylvana that Josh mentioned, wash those leaves, and then you think flash saute of dandelion with bits of bacon that crunch. And you finish it with a splash of good tasting vinegar. Now, you put the whole thing on top of toasted country bread that you've rubbed with lots of garlic. The wine is going to love this. Remember the rosé that Josh mentioned? Well, that would taste great with fresh fava beans or the first peas. Now, you eat them raw with either slices of country ham or maybe some prosciutto. And that red from the Rhone that was so fresh tasting, that's the one that I want to try with a stir fry of wild baby greens and sea scallops with maybe some fresh ginger. Can't you imagine how that wine is going to taste with those sweet scallops? Okay, these are just ideas for us to fiddle with right now. You know, there's really nothing wrong with planning a meal around the wine instead of the reverse. Well, coming up, the genius of Chef Paul Bertoli, where the locals eat in Las Vegas, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. When people talk about America's outstanding culinary talents, Paul Bertoli is always on the short list. He's a California chef. His restaurant is Olivetto in North Berkeley. But Paul is more than a chef. He's also an artisan. He cures his own hams and salami. He makes balsamic vinegar. He even mills the flours for his polentas and pastas. Now, obviously, for this man, food is at the core of who he is. So it's not surprising that he has written one of the most thoughtful books of cooking that I've seen. It is Cooking by Hand. Paul Bertoli, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Paul, why do you feel you have to make all these things, do all these things?
First of all, I love to do this. I mean, it's my passion. It's my passion to be in the vineyard in the fall, you know, collecting the grapes to make wine and to make vinegar. I think as a chef, I feel it's also my responsibility to understand as much as I can about my materials and to question them. I mean, when I was making pasta using just regular bagged flour all the time, I could only take that so far. And now this exploration of flour, I'm grinding grains and whatnot, has really given me the ability to kind of fine-tune the pasta making at Oliveto.
Mm-hmm. I want to read a section from your book. It's a section entitled Ripeness. You write, "Ripeness cheats time. Ripeness embodies all something has ever been and the most it will ever be. Yet in its brief, glowing completeness, the moment of ripeness seems timeless." How does this shape your cooking? How does this shape what happens in your kitchen?
I think that the appreciation and the discernment of ripeness is at the very heart of what I try to do. This applies not only to fruits and vegetables, which, you know, I think achieve that moment
mm-hmm.
In the garden or in the marketplace. You can see it. It's tangible. It's an extremely compelling, at least for me, aspect of cooking. And then I'm excited by the ingredient. I want to go and I want to cook it. I want to understand it. I want to take it apart and, you know, have my food express what that ingredient is about. But I think it also applies to things like braises, for instance. How do you develop a sense of the ripe flavors of a braise, you know, and what are the combination of ingredients that'll get you there? What it is really for me is about tracking deliciousness. And when I go into my taste memory
mm-hmm.
and I think back on these dishes that I've had that have just knocked my socks off, I'm going after that. And ripeness is the path, you know, it's where I start. And it's hopefully where I end up as well.
So it's the peak.
Mm-hmm.
It's the peak. You don't hold much with recipes. You've said in the book that recipes are not something that you feel is important in achieving this. Now, can you talk a little bit about that?
I think, in fact, they work against the process in so much as they tend to focus the chef's attention or the cook's attention on a formula to the detriment of the responsiveness that one develops by looking at, tasting, understanding ingredients.
You make balsamic vinegar, which
yes.
is, yeah, no simple thing. You made some to commemorate the birth of your son.
What I did is I started a series of casks, which he will inherit. And the vinegar, I don't know if listeners know this, but in Italy, balsamic vinegar is, the traditional balsamic vinegar is released only after 12 years of age. And so I had this image of my son opening this bottle when he was 12 years old and having an exquisite vinegar ready for him.
Uh-huh.
But more than that, I think it's, I was so captivated when I went to Italy and began to understand this very, very old tradition in the Emilia-Romagna area, where it's not only just a way of making a wonderful vinegar, but it's sort of a way of keeping time with the people that you love. And because the vinegar is a process that has no necessary endpoint. Some of the new must of the vintage is added to the old each year, and so you have this blend of the old and new.
The pressed juice of the grape.
That's right.
Yeah.
And when I went to Italy and I saw all of these families with barrels up in their attics with their sons and friends' names on them, dear ones' names on them, I just thought this is a marvelous way of commemorating a person's life.
Yeah, since that vinegar can age a century, it could mark the moments of his life as it ages.
That's what I had in mind.
Paul, where do you want to be in 10 years? What do you want to be doing?
I think I would really like to just live off the land somewhere. That's my dream. I love the garden. I love the wild. And I love domestic chores, believe it or not. Making bread, plowing the soil, preparing preserves, things like that. I don't know why, it just makes me very happy. It makes me feel like my life is essential, you know. there's an essential aspect to it that is based on these very simple things, you know.
Well, maybe some of us will be lucky enough to be around the table with you then. Hey, thank you,
Paul.
Oh,
I hope so. You're very welcome.
Paul Bertoli is chef and owner of Oliveto Restaurant in North Berkeley, California. His book is Cooking by Hand. Now, Paul left us with a recipe for chicken in vinegar sauce. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Las Vegas used to be the place for the ideal surreal vacation and for cheap eats. Well, it's still wonderfully surreal, but the prices have gone up. And nearly every super chef in America has opened a restaurant there. I mean, the $100 dinner is just for openers. So the big question is, where do the locals eat? Well, for the answer, we have the expert on the Las Vegas food scene. He is Max Jacobson, restaurant critic for Las Vegas Weekly. Max Jacobson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Well, you know, I want to know, aside from the buffets and the big name chefs, what are the major influences on food in Las Vegas?
Well, you know, I think Las Vegas is a microcosm of American culture, and what's happened in every American city has happened here. There's just more of it. So all these foreign influences have sort of seeped into American culture, but more so here and more all at once.
I want to explore how that plays in the food scene, but what brought the big chefs out?
You know, it's interesting. Steve Wynn gets a lot of the credit.
He's the visionary. Man who created the Bellagio, right?
Yes, and before that, the Mirage, which was really the first major strip hotel that was a real resort, a real destination with white tigers and palm trees and all this incredible stuff. And he basically thought, give them buffets, give them a gourmet room for the high rollers. He didn't really think about food that much. And then a man here named Larry Ruvo, I think, who was his partner, kind of turned Steve's head. I think that he had a major hand in convincing Mr. Wynn that big chefs and great food would sell. And I think they realized over time that the revenues for food and beverage would eventually come close to the gaming revenues. And once they made that revelation, you know, then everybody wanted to jump onto the bandwagon. Of course, the first major chef to come here was Wolfgang Puck. And in the beginning, you know, when he opened Spago in Caesar's Palace, you know, the first few days he told me he was standing around and people were coming in. They were looking for the buffets. They, you know, he was really scared. And then it took off. And then, of course, the success of that is what really buoyed these other men to recruit these major chefs.
Mm-hmm. So where do the locals go?
Well, the locals have a lot of options. Of course, there are a lot of neighborhood restaurants and a lot of small ethnic restaurants. There's a Bulgarian community in Las Vegas.
Really?
And there's a Bulgarian restaurant. L.A. doesn't even have a Bulgarian restaurant. And it's called Magura, and I love the place. And there's the goulash pot for if you want Hungarian food. And there's restaurant Ilisevsky, which is named after a famous food store in Moscow, which I gathered during the Brezhnev era didn't even have ketchup. But now is like sort of like the William Sonoma slash Dean and DeLuca of Russia. And, you know, the Polish restaurant was called Polonaise, and they just changed their name to Euro Show for whatever reason. And, you know, there's just a ton of these places all over town.
You did a list of your favorite dishes of 2003, and one of them that really struck me was from Shanghai. It was...
Yeah, I love that dish.
Yeah.
Well, it's a simmered beef pancake is what they call it.
Oh, wow.
You know, the Chinese, they like... beef to be very tender. And what they do is they simmer it in things like star anise, and, you know, which gives it sort of a licorice-y flavor, and five spice powder, which, you know, has ginger and coriander and all this wonderful exotic stuff in it. And then they slice it very, very thin, and then they take a grilled flatbread pancake and they roll it up with scallions, and they serve you this thing. It's like a primordial wrap. You get three or four of them. It's about $3.95 in this restaurant, Shanghai Noon. And it's a real meal. And the owner of this restaurant is a very famous guy in Asia. He's called Sammo Hung, and he used to have a TV show in America, Martial Law. And this place is real authentic Shanghainese food, cold dishes and all kinds of great stuff.
How about some other places?
Well, I have a little Japanese pub that I go to called Genki, which actually means health in Japanese. Genkite, which is not a sushi bar. And many times I've eaten there, people have poked their noses in the door and said, "Where's the sushi bar?" And the chef sort of grunts, "No sushi." And the customers turn around and leave. And they don't know what they're missing, because it's great. Eat things like chow and mushy custard and broiled Spanish mackerel, aji, broiled aji, and smelts and little Japanese noodle dishes. And it's a great place.
Now, if I said to you, "I'd like to have one meal in Las Vegas, and I would love it to be an old-time Vegas experience," where would you take me?
Well, I would have sent you to the Venetian, which is closed, which was this wonderful old place where you could eat the pork neck bones and, you know, Italian greens. There's also a place on the south end of the Strip called the Bootlegger Bistro, which is owned by our lieutenant governor, Lorraine Hunt, and her mother, who's in her late 80s, is still in the kitchen. And that's a sort of an old Vegas Italian experience. And then downtown, there's Hugo's Cellar, where you take a private elevator in the Four Queens Casino, and the ladies get a rose, and they have a salad bar that they bring to the table, and you just point to everything you want, and they'll put like 900 things on your plate. And then you get, you know, beef Wellington or lobster bisque or whatever they used to eat back in the Jurassic era.
Sounds like great contrast. Hey, Max, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Max Jacobson is restaurant critic for Las Vegas Weekly. Now, we've got his restaurant suggestions on the website, splendidtable.org. Leave it to New York City to reinvent a classic, the Dinner Theater. Now, if you've picked up a New York paper lately, you've noticed the slew of dinner/eating/theater events happening all over the city, not only in theaters, I mean, even in people's living rooms. Reporter John Kalish has this story.
You know Daniel, my oldest?
A 26-year-old actor named David Wise dresses as a woman and performs a solo show called Mama's Knishes in people's kitchens and dining rooms. It's a recreation of a 1938 Brooklyn kitchen, and Wise teaches participants how to make potato knishes, all the while detailing family foibles in a Yiddish accent.
So who's going to go first? You're going to go?
Why not?
Go wash your hands. I'm going to make everyone wash their hands. It's not just you.
Participants roll out the dough, place potato filling on it, and fashion small knishes out of the stuff.
You don't want to go back and forth. You just want to press down so that it seals it.
Towards the end of the performance, the aroma and then the freshly baked knishes emerge from the kitchen. And the audience eats.
To be an audience member at a performance like this is a little bit of work.
Actor David Wise.
You don't know exactly how to participate. You don't know how to be part of it. Anything can really happen because, you know, when you let people participate, they do.
An audience of 300 can dine at the Supper Club in Manhattan and catch Chef's Theater, in which Broadway actors sing and famous chefs cook in a luxury kitchen on stage.
My famous macchiato, my homemade gelato,
my trip with tonato.
You win.
My Asian zucchini with garlic tahini.
Among the great cooks slated to appear is Michael LaMonaco, the former executive chef at Windows on the World, and now a chef at a Latin American restaurant called Noche.
I think Julia Child really showed us all that really we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously. So Chef's Theater is really about not taking ourselves too seriously as restaurant professionals.
In an off-Broadway theater, a nonverbal performance called Cookin' features Korean cooks drumming up a storm while preparing a wedding barbecue. Cookin' is equal parts slapstick choreography, acrobatics, and percussion. The chefs chop vegetables with knives and get into a bit of a food fight.
The percussion with the knives, that was pretty wild. Using those knives is pretty dangerous, and they made some pretty interesting music.
In a Manhattan loft, Ed Schmidt has been performing something called The Last Supper, but a better title might be The Lost Supper. Schmidt realizes the carp he bought for the evening's meal has mistakenly been frozen. One of the biggest laughs of the night comes when Schmidt takes the frozen fish out and bangs it on the counter of his kitchen island. Schmidt fools the audience into believing he has ordered pizza to feed them, but the pizza never arrives.
Yes. No, 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 no. Eat, it's West. It's 154 West 27. You know what? Tell him it's West.
At the end of the performance, a curtain flies open, revealing rows of candlelit dining tables and a waiting dinner.
There are some nights where everybody falls for it. There's some nights where it seems like nobody does. To me, the best audience members seem to be people who don't know where I'm taking them. They know I'm taking them on some sort of ride, but on some level they trust me, and they're willing to go along on the ride.
The ride includes lamb stew, a tossed salad, rosemary bread, and choice of ginger or maple ice cream. Audience member Erica Marcus happens to be a food writer for the Long Island newspaper Newsday.
I thought he could have used a fattier cut of lamb, but I appreciated that it was lamb and not beef. That showed some real faith in the audience. The bread, excellent. Nice salad. He had two kinds of beets in it, the golden beets and the choga beets. Excellent peanut butter cookies. He went and got the best ice cream.
Everybody is a critic. Well, reporter John Kalish is based in New York City. Guys, it is time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What does the word psyllivy mean? Now, I've got a hint. It has to do with breakfast, and you may know somebody who does it. We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we will be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Well, we'll be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what does the word psyllivy mean? Well, It's the collecting of egg cups. And believe it or not, if you were in England in 1911 and bought a set of nickel silver egg cups with spoons for $1.75, they were being sold at Harrods, today they would be worth $320. Ancient egg cups have shown up in the ruins of Pompeii. France's Louis XV used the egg cup for feats of daring do. The entire court would gather to watch him, I'm quoting here, decapitate an egg in a single stroke. Well, this and so much more comes from a site called Egg Cup World, and it comes out of the UK. And of course, the UK is where breakfast is taken very seriously. Well, there's another breakfast collectible. It's the toast rack, which I see as having deep psychosocial significance. I think the toast rack is proof of the British love-hate relationship with food. Consider this. Why would a nation hold dear an instrument designed to serve up stone-cold toast?
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We have got Nancy on the line from Knoxville. Nancy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I am a vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
I can eat eggs and milk, so I guess I'd be an ovo-lacto-vegetarian.
Okay.
I'm a student, and I'm a terrible cook. I can burn water. I have problems making instant pancakes. I mean, I'm not a good cook.
I hear you. I hear you. So what can I help you with?
Can you suggest any good vegetarian cookbooks that are pretty simple, and or any recipes that are going to be nutritious but simple, not difficult to make?
You know, this business, I think, about being a bad cook, a lot of it may be also, you know, it may be not that you're a bad cook, but you're a student, you probably have a life that's really hectic. And focus is sometimes hard.
You know? Yeah, this is true.
Okay, let's see. You know the first book that comes to mind, and the name alone of the author is enough to have you jazzed up. Her name is Crescent Dragon Wagon, which is, you will not forget this name.
No.
She's vegan.
Okay.
But she's not militant about it. And certainly in places where she, you know, doesn't use dairy, you could drop it in if you wished and you could drop eggs in. But the book is called Passionate Vegetarian. The recipes are simple. The flavors are sensational. And there's a lot of things in there that do not take a lot of time. And Lord knows they are not expensive.
Okay.
So, you know, for somebody on a student budget who doesn't have a lot of time, and the other thing, there's things in there that when you get time, you make the thing that's easy to freeze. You know, you make the stew or you make the soup, and it's the kind of thing you put it in small containers, you stick it in the freezer, and on those nights when you just don't have any time, you pull it out. But I think Crescent Dragon Wagon, Passionate Vegetarian. And the other person that comes to mind is Deborah Madison. Anything by Deborah Madison. She's done one called Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone, and the other newer book is Local. But anything by Deborah Madison, simple, delicious, and most of the recipes very inexpensive.
Okay.
Okay, so that should launch you. And trust me, it's going to get better.
Okay.
All right, Nancy.
I just bought a new house, so I hope I don't set it on fire with my...
Nah. You know what? Read the recipe through, take a deep breath, gather all the ingredients, take another deep breath, and then just exhale and be at one with the universe, and you're going to be fine.
Great. great. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. You are welcome. 800-537-5252. You know, it's tough. Some of us just don't have instincts. Like, if you ask me to deal with a computer, I'm lost. I'm lost. We have Carolyn on the line from Minneapolis. Hey, Carolyn, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Lynn, thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I want to talk about spices.
Okay.
I have spices in my cupboard that I know are 10 years old.
Collector's items.
Yeah, yeah.
These are antiques.
Yes. How long do spices last?
Well, you want the good news or the bad news? ground spices and things that are leafy, you know, like herbs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
3 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Whole spices, peppercorns, whole, you know, allspice, yeah, that kind of thing, a year.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now, but what you do have are collector's items. Now, some of that packaging will never be seen again. You may want to keep some of that
stuff.
Okay.
All right. Appreciate the information.
Look at all the clear shelf space you're going to have.
Yes.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, this business about using fresh spices, I can't tell you the difference it makes. You know, all of us have stuff that's been hanging around, and then you wonder why your food doesn't have a lot of taste. The spices are dead. Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Gina calling from Portland. Gina, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about bamboo.
Bamboo?
Bamboo.
Yeah?
My husband and I just bought a house,
uh-huh,
and there are wonderful fruit trees on the property. And the family that lived here before us was from Laos. And as they were showing us the house, they were telling us how they would take the new bamboo shoots, cut them, and boil them and eat them.
Ah, so you have bamboo growing on the property?
Yes, I have a beautiful little bamboo stand.
Oh.
And I guess that's how they kept it from spreading too far into the property.
Yeah, I've never lived in a climate where bamboo did well, but I understand it can really spread like mint.
It can, and it did well during our winter snowstorms.
Uh-huh, that's great.
It's still doing well, and what concerns me is that apparently new shoots come out twice a year, which is spring and autumn.
Yeah, that's right.
I've done some research because I understand that you can't eat it without boiling it.
That's correct. That's what I understand anyway.
But at no place can I find how long do I have to boil it for? How do I know when it's ready to be used for eating?
Right now, my brain, if you could photograph it, looks like one of those old room-size computers shuffling through all of the cards to find, because I know at one point I read about I think there's information, if I remember, there's a book called Thai Food by David Thompson. It's a fabulous, big, thick book. And I think that's where I read about it. The two things that stay in my mind, okay, number one is that you take the shoots when they're barely visible coming out of the ground. That's the first thing I remember. You dig them out, essentially.
Right.
The other thing I remember is that you must handle it with gloves because evidently the outside of them have fine hairs that are quite sharp and they stick to everything.
Okay.
That's at least, again, this is what I read that I'm recalling. The third thing I remember, I'm remembering four things I just realized. The third thing I remember is the way you peel it is you're going for the inner core, which is sort of whitish.
Almost like the heart of a palm?
Yes. And the idea is that you handle it with gloves and you slit it pretty deeply and you peel away the outer layers and you get to this white fleshy core.
Now, on some of the books I've seen, they're showing new shoots that are probably inches across, like 6 inches across.
Yes, yeah.
Now, mine is very small.
Yours is tiny. I have a feeling there's lots of different kinds of bamboo.
Right.
I would still make the cut and see where you hit a really fleshy interior. I don't think it's super soft, but it's going to be, you know, it's going to be fleshy. It's not going to look wooden or fibrous the way the exterior does. But the thing that I remember most about this is when you get to that core, you wash it, you stick it in salted water, and you do this as fast as you can after it comes out of the earth, and you put it into cold water, you bring it to a boil, you drain it, you repeat that two times more, and then it's ready for like stir fries and other stuff. So it's cold water, bring to boil, drain. Cold water, bring to boil, drain. Cold water, bring to boil, drain. And that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, see if that works.
Any suggestions for recipes? I mean, there's obvious stir fry, but...
Well, you know what I'm thinking is that if you do a stir fry of them, a very light stir fry of them, and then maybe just have them at room temperature drizzled with something like, you know, just put toasted sesame seed over them, a tad of sesame oil, and maybe a little bit of rice vinegar, I would imagine, because they're going to be so flavorful, aren't they? They're delicate, I know. They're not hit over your head kind of thing. But I think that very, something really simple with them.
Lynn, thank you so much.
You are welcome. I'm jealous. I want my own grove. Hey, thanks, Gina.
You're welcome.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Okay, bring on my waist-high fireplace in the house, and I want my own bamboo grove. 800-537-5252. We have Peter calling from Indianapolis. Peter, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I'd like to talk about restaurant schools. I worked in restaurants when I was in high school and college as a prep cook mostly, and I was always impressed with the people that I worked with who had trained at the CIA and places like that.
Right.
I spend a lot of time during the day working from recipes in my lab, and so when I get home, I tend to cook from the hip.
Right.
And except I don't have the background and I don't have the intuition that I think you just alluded to. So what I'd like to do is try to find a short course where I could go and maybe spend a week or two and spend some time learning, you know, basic theory for everything pretty much except for desserts.
Right.
I'm coming up on a milestone birthday, and my wife's told me I can reward myself with whatever I want, and she ruled out Amsterdam, so I figured I'd try something like this.
So you want to stay in the United States?
I'd like to stay either in the U.S. or Canada.
Okay. By the way, what do you do? You mentioned your lab. What do you do?
I'm a scientist.
You are?
Biomedical research.
Ah, okay. Oh, you're going to bring a lot to this. You're going to find this is going to be really easy for you and so pleasurable. It, depending on where you want to go in the country, okay? Now, the Culinary Institute of America, very famous two-year school, is in Hyde Park, New York, but they've opened a branch called Greystone in the Napa Valley. And they offer, I think, short-term programs. I know they offer long weekend programs that are open to the public as well as to people with long-term commitments to the school. That's one of the schools. I think just also being in that area where if you have a car, you have Napa at your fingertips, but you have the Mendocino area, you have Sonoma, you've got wonderful farms. You know, I mean, it's a glorious area for a holiday,
yeah.
But you'll really be getting some very good training.
Great.
While you're there. So that's one thing. The Hyde Park School also has programs. Boston College is really interesting because, and I'm doing this, you know, I'm on top of my head. I'd say certainly check this out. Not all of this may be correct. But they were one of the first schools in the country to offer a degree in gastronomy, embracing cooking, history, culture, etc.
Oh, that sounds perfect.
But I've done classes there for their restaurant training section. And there are a lot of people there like you who are looking at this as either something they want to fill in on or something that's going to be a second career. And Rebecca Alsett, if I remember, ran the course when I was there, which was quite a while ago. But check out Boston College.
Okay.
New York City and Boston, again, a fabulous place to be for a week or two. You know, I mean, a city you could just explore 16 ways from Tuesday. The other thing is New York City. There is the French Culinary Institute. There is the, I think it's called the New York School of Culinary Training. It used to be Peter Kump's. The overall thing here is there is an organization called the International Organization of Culinary Professionals, the IACP. They're based in Louisville, Kentucky, and they will have a list of cooking schools all over the country. Not necessarily all of them are for training chefs specifically, but they'll offer a broad variety of programs. But I would say if you think about the Napa Valley, you think about Boston and you think about New York. There's also Johnston Wales in Providence, Rhode Island. They have other branches in other places.
Yeah, I saw one in Miami last week, I think.
Yes. Now, Miami, what a scene to visit. You know, I mean, you're looking at the whole Latin influence now on food in this country, and you'll be slap dab in the middle of it.
Right.
So I'd say that's good places to begin, and check the IACP website as well.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, enjoy.
Thanks.
And congratulations on the birthday.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Goodbye. Bye. Well, something rather spooky happened recently at a frozen fish company in Connecticut. The company is TrueFresh, and they've been freezing salmon for years. Then they decided to experiment with lobster. Well, to tell the tale, we have TrueFresh chairman Barnett Liberman on the line. Barnett, thanks for talking with us.
Good morning.
Barnett, now, I understand that you've been freezing salmon, and then you decided to experiment with live lobster. So could you tell us what happened then?
Well, actually, we were freezing salmon 9 years ago in Lubeck, Maine. And in Maine, the down east, there are a great group of industrious people, and among them are lobstermen, blueberry pickers, reeders, and they're all the same person. Of course, they vary from season to season to keep mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. They also worked in the salmon factory, and one of them, while we were freezing the salmon, asked how it would work on lobster. And we said, let's try it. Well, we did, and we had a half dozen lobsters, and they had a great time freezing them, and they ate a number of them. And one that they didn't eat was left and began to reanimate after a couple of hours.
You mean it came to life?
Yes, it came back to life. So that was interesting. But we didn't think much of it because we weren't in the business of doing it. But about 4 months ago, when we decided to launch our retail business with a website, we thought about the lobster again and how that clearly demonstrated the efficacy of the quick freeze process. And we videotaped that happening. Now, it doesn't happen every time, but when it does happen, it's quite remarkable, and it proves the process.
So these lobsters are alive?
Well, not all of them. It happens maybe 1 in 20 times, or I think we've done about 200 that had 12 or 13 come back. So,
you're thinking of perfecting this so you can give us live lobster?
Not sure it's a consumer-friendly item. Mrs. American Housewife preparing a romantic lobster dinner may get out of the mood if the lobster starts, knocking on the side of the pot.
So how does a frozen lobster taste after you defrost it?
Well, everybody says it tastes great.
But just to be on the safe side, you want to keep the rubber bands the claws.
You don't want to take off the rubber bands.
Okay. All right. Hey, Barnett, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Barnett Liberman is chairman of TrueFresh in Suffield, Connecticut. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought for spring from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, "The earth laughs in flowers." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on the website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Register for it on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.